this is my weekly podcast, Adventures with Postpartum Depression, a show dedicated to sharing stories and spreading awareness about maternal mood disorders. For show notes and more information, please go to my website, ppdadventures.com. There's also a Facebook page, facebook.com/ppdadventures. And now, on to the show. Hi everyone, it's episode 41, and today we're going to have part 2 of Sandy's interview. As promised, last week's episode was sort of her story, the more chronology, and this week's episode is us just talking more about postpartum depression and the writing of a memoir and just getting all like coffee shop, like cerebral, felt very much like a flashback to college when I was having these fun discussions with friends instead of studying and writing papers. So I hope you enjoy this episode, and I am just trying to get this introduction out without having a coughing fit. It's been, man, a rough week and a half health-wise for me in terms of first some really bad PMS aggravated with Zoloft withdrawal, and I've decided to just stay at 75 milligrams for now. I'm seeing my psychiatrist in a couple days, going to talk it over with her, because I feel like the 75 to 50 easing down has not really been as gentle as the others. So maybe I just need to stick with 75 for a bit, and for a bit could mean for the next 2 months, and for a bit could mean the rest of my life. I don't know. It's an adventure. We'll find out. And then I've had this cough, and it's been like something that it's just like it's in the lungs, but it's in the throat, and then it turned into like a stomach bug over the weekend. It's just been a real shit storm for health symptoms for me and Julian, and Pippa's just sort of floating above it all, la-di-da. She's probably bringing the germs home from preschool. She probably had it last year, and now it's our turn, so oh well, c'est la vie. But okay, last week, episode 40, I have re-uploaded the episode because in the beginning I edited it weird, and so you heard two voices talking over each other for the first minute, and then it went into, you know, hopefully more normal voice quality. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to episode 40, but you've already downloaded it and you're listening to this in real time, I'm recording this on May 2nd, 2017. If you're here in the first, you know, as all this happens, and you haven't listened to episode 40, you might want to delete it and re-download it and hear Sandy's story first before you listen to this episode. Unless you're feeling all cerebral and coffee shoppy right now, or, you know, a pub, I don't know. You know, we all get to talking, you know, with our knitting needles or while watching a baseball game, you know, everything, it's all different for all of us. So something I didn't really get to talking about last week, as I was distracted by Julian and the beginnings of whatever I've had. You know, I don't even know if it's I've had back-to-back viruses or I've just had one really weird-ass virus. And, you know, you throw in the PMS and the Zoloft withdrawal. It is just hard to keep a handle. And, of course, I overanalyze things because it's like, okay, my stomach's off. Is that really the virus or is that anxiety? And if it's anxiety, do I need to up my Zoloft back? I don't know. I think it really is the stomach bug. And I've heard a lot of people in Pasadena who've had a stomach bug. So it's like, okay, good. I'm not just inventing this. It's not an invention when it's anxiety, but it's a different treatment. It's a different, you know, do I need to talk about this with my therapist or my psychiatrist? Or do I need to just drink lots of Gatorade and eat some bland bread and ride this out? So it's funny when you bring in mental illness, suddenly everything is just complicated. There's all these other layers that get added on, and a stomach ache is no longer necessarily just a stomach ache. It's, have I not been taking good enough care of myself? Have I not been getting enough exercise and burning off enough, you know, creating enough good feeling chemicals? And you can see I am just brain dead. I can't pull anything out of my brain right now, because physical illness affects my mental well-being too. And I know I've had a stomach bug. It's just been a bitch and a half. So, episode 40, probably want to listen to that first. But if you're more in the mood for episode 41, you know, it's a good number. It's a prime number, right? Well, I don't know. I can't. That's way beyond my brain power right now. Sandy's book, if you'll recall, is Dancing on the Edge of Sanity. And you can find her Facebook page at mydanceontheedgeofsanity.com. That's like her blog, and she's also on Facebook. And you can get her book through Amazon or through her publisher directly on CreateSpace. Her memoir, I would have to say, I'm going to recommend her memoir to anyone who has recovered from postpartum depression and or any other maternal mood disorder, or someone who is trying to support a loved one who's going through this experience and wants to understand more what's happening to them. Or I'm basically going to recommend it to anyone interested in this topic, except those of you who are right now in the absolute darkness. Her memoir is really raw and intense, and it could be triggering. And again, I don't like to abuse trigger warnings, but Sandy had this extreme experience where she went to the ER for help, and then the ER really bumbled things up and sent her to this psychiatric unit. And the psychiatric unit, it was the weekend and there weren't doctors around, and it seems like whoever was working on her case in the ER wasn't recording things correctly because she was, the notes suggest they thought she was homicidal and she just wasn't there. So I think it could be very alarming for someone who is in the trenches right now, because, and I do think it's a really important story, and I'm so grateful she wrote it because we need to see how maternal mental health is being bumbled still, and why we need to work on this, and why we need to spread awareness about things that are so basic. And, but that said, if you know you're in a very raw place where you're struggling to get the help you need, wait on this one. And then maybe it'll actually be really cathartic to see how difficult it can be to get the right help that you need, to communicate the things going on inside you. So just put this on like your wish list on Amazon, but don't buy it just yet unless you've recovered or you're in the place where you could process all of those great and good feelings. And so I'm just going to say one more time, episode 40 has been re-uploaded to be correct for future generations. But, you know, just go with your mistakes. See, the world did not end. I remember Sandy told me a few days ago, like, the episode's great, but I think, like, I'm hearing two voices in the first minute. And I went and I did not have the health to actually replay it until this morning. And then I heard it. I'm like, yep, that would be two voices. That would be me talking, you know, two different recorded bits overlapped on the recording info. And, you know, I don't feel really horribly ashamed about putting it out there. Like most of you who are going to listen to episode 40 will never know, because most of you are out there in the future. Hello to the future. And you will never, the new, pure, correctly edited episode 40 is out there. And you'll never, you would never have been the wiser but for me talking about it now in episode 41. But I want you to know that we're all human and we all make mistakes. And especially in motherhood, mistakes are going to happen. There is no perfect mother. There are infinite number of ways to be a good enough mother. There is just no way to be a perfect mother. And there's no way to be a perfect human. There's no way to be a perfect podcaster. I mean, maybe if you're a professional and you have, you know, people working for you and they are editing and then they recheck and they recheck. But I'm just one woman. I'm a one-woman show here. And I want to encourage all of you listening, because I know some of you are probably thinking, I'd like to do this. And you should. You should really think about doing a podcast. I think women's voices have been silenced and muffled for too long. And now we don't live in those tight-knit villages with our extended families anymore. And with the people we grew up with, we scatter. And it's harder. We're constantly starting from ground zero with people, and like, it's not like you have all the same friends you've had since you were two. You have, I have friends from grade school. I mean, those people aren't even in my life anymore. And it's just like my life has been very fractured in terms of high school in one place, and then college on the other side of the country, and then law school, and then being a lawyer. And it's just been very fragmented in terms of like trying to like make really good friends. And I have some really good friends, but none of them, some of them do live close to me, but those are the newer friendships, and there's just nothing that substitutes time. So what I'm rambling on is women's stories are so important. And since we don't live in these tight-knit communities, and I don't want to like romanticize the Middle Ages since they had the bubonic plague and all of that horrifying shit going on. I'm not one of those people to be like, oh, if only I could have lived in the Middle Ages. They didn't have indoor plumbing. I would not have liked the Middle Ages. I'm not suggesting that. But we don't live in these communities where these stories are really easily accessible. And so I think having a podcast, more podcasts about maternal mental health would be great, but all sorts of women's issues. I mean, I would love to see a show just called I Have My Period and everyone telling their different stories about their menstrual cycle, because it's one of those things that's just so part of our lives, but we don't necessarily talk about it that much. And, I would love to have more of those stories out there. I'd love to have podcasts about miscarriages and infertility. And I'm just, of course, there thinking in terms of, once again, the motherhood cycle. There's just so many different parts about being female that I would love to see out there. But anyway, now I'm getting all talky-talky and my voice is hurting and I'm going to have a coughing fit coming on. So let's turn it back over to Sandy and me talking through some stuff that was inspired by our initial interview in episode 40. And I'll see you on the flip side.
It is kind of funny because when I was walking out the door, like I was walking out the door of this mental hospital, and this woman comes running up to me and she's like, "Hi, I'm the dietitian. I know that you never got a chance to meet with me, but this is my card. And as a nursing mother, blah, 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 you need certain things and I'd love to be in touch with you." And that was nice. Like, so there were some good things about that hospital. And it was funny because I really, again, maybe naively thought, but when the crisis worker at the hospital, the ER, told me that I'd go to this hospital and I'd get all this help I needed, I kind of expected it like the minute I got there. I didn't know they meant like, you'll get it sometime in the next, day or so when the doctors come on. So when I arrived at this hospital, it was basically what I would call just like a holding tank. It was just all these people who were distressed for various reasons. And we're all just there and they're like, "Here's some crayons, here's some color, here's some puzzles." And, and some people were going out on walks and I wasn't allowed to do that because I was like, I read my medical records and it said that I was suicidal. And it also said that I was homicidal, but then that was crossed out. So somewhere, that's what the ER had said about me, that I was suicidal and homicidal. And then they crossed out homicidal, but I still saw it. And after the fact, much later after the fact. So I was on like high watch, and I wasn't allowed to go for walks. But, and I would say that my night at that hospital was probably the hardest night of my life, and it was definitely like I felt completely abandoned by everybody, by my husband, by my family. Well, not really by my family, but the fact that they couldn't save me. Like I guess abandoned isn't the right word. I felt alone. I felt more alone than I ever felt. And I felt like I knew that I could get through this and that the world right now wasn't helping me and that I had to stop. I actually was like, "You have to stop reaching out for help. Like, you got into this mess because you asked for help." And it's I worry about my book. I worry about people reading it and thinking, "So I'm not going to ask for help because look what happened to her." But I think there's a lot of other factors that got me to that point of why, asking for help ended up me being in a mental institution that wasn't helpful for me.
Well, I think your story is so necessary because, one, it's there for the practitioners to maybe learn some compassion and to learn. I mean, they should have known, like, Because I remember there was some like to do about this is the only place we can send you, and it's like, no, you guys should know where the mother child units are, and you should be able to like tell your patients, we can't do this, but 6 hours away, there is this place for you. You know, like there needs to be some more out of the box thinking. And I think it's also an important story because we can see like how it's easy to like get confused about like where does postpartum psychosis start and end, and what is going on with intrusive thoughts, and you know, how can we understand and articulate our own experiences. And I'm sure there are so many women who not necessarily were hospitalized, but who thought they were being perceived as having a more serious illness than they had, and not so much to worry about the stigma, but like what is the appropriate treatment, because the medication for psychosis is not what's going to help you
right
if you have bipolar disorder or anxiety or something. And it's just, we just need all of our stories out there, so no guilt about that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I know wonderful women who had to deal with postpartum psychosis and live through it and are stronger because of it, you know? And I feel like part of what I was doing when I wrote my book, or what, I mean, one of the things that I know was one of my thoughts at one point was like, what did I have? Like, and it really wasn't like I was like, well, I don't want to have had postpartum psychosis because it's this big, scary, awful thing. It was just like, but that wasn't what I experienced. And if I, good thing that I wasn't like that the psychiatrist didn't think I had that and put me on antipsychotic medication, because that wouldn't have been what I needed. And I agree with what you said about like practitioners. Like when I wrote this book, somebody at one point said to me, "Oh, this is so great! This is going to help so many other mothers." And I thought, I don't know. Like, I didn't write for that audience. I mean, maybe for the mother who's gone through it and is better now. But I think it could possibly be a really hard book for a woman to read who's going through any of this right now. But their loved ones, to know what it's like and to really understand intrusive thoughts, or definitely doctors, or for anyone who doesn't know why we need more education. Like, I feel like this, my book tells the story of, look, people need, the world needs a little more education about the multiple ways in which postpartum depression and anxiety mood disorders can manifest. It was kind of a turning point for me, I think, when I realized that I had a lot of inner wisdom. And I did yoga, and I was doing yoga. This was at the hospital, and I just did yoga into the night. And I mean, I also learned later on about like anti-anxiety medications. Like, I really needed something like that. Like, it probably would have been wonderful if someone had given me an anti-anxiety, or even just a little melatonin to help me sleep or something. But I feel like, you know, like someone is getting their teeth drilled and they didn't have like Novocaine. I was dealing with like super intense anxiety, and then I'm in a situation that's making it more anxious, and I'm all the things that I know and love I'm not allowed to be around. And I was like, all right, like, you're a strong woman. Like, you're going to get through this, Sandy. And no, none of these people there that were supposed to be helping were even saying that to me. And I guess that's like a great thing for life in any situation. Like, if anyone's going to help you, you are going to help you. And, you know, I hear people talk about, you know, this organization or this person or reading this book saved me. And from, you know, postpartum depression. And I actually feel like, and I can proudly and, yes, with a lot of pride, I can say, I saved me. And I think a lot of it started that night in the hospital. And I was like, I'm not letting this bring me down. And I'm not listening to this. You know, it was kind of also like, I'm like, am I crazy? Am I crazy? And then the answer that I was getting from the world is, yes, you're really crazy. And then my answer came back and it was like, no, I'm not. I'm not really that, you know, whatever you think I am, that I need to be locked up and watched every 15 minutes. What I need is, I need to be with my son, and I need sleep, And, you know, and I really kind of thought about all that stuff. And I did meet with a psychiatrist at this place, and I think it happened at like 1 p.m. And, you know, with my anxiety, I had wanted it to happen the minute I got there, not 24 hours later. But I met with this lady, and she was kind of good a little bit, but also not good, because she was like, you don't have postpartum depression. You don't have any kind of depression at all. Like, you shouldn't be here. And or she didn't say you shouldn't be here, but it's not necessary for you to be here. And the only thing about her that was really confusing and hard for me at the time was that she started like putting down my midwives. And then I was really confused, because they had been so wonderful in other areas. And she was like, I can't believe they prescribed you Zoloft, you know, midwives. I didn't know midwives can even prescribe medicine. And you shouldn't be breastfeeding on that. And you have a choice. You can either, if you want to stay on it, stay on it. But you have anxiety anyway, so you shouldn't be on something for depression, which, like, all of this is really not good advice as far as I think. But I guess the best thing about her was that she told me I should go home from the place. But so she basically told me I needed to stop Zoloft and continue breastfeeding, or continue the Zoloft, and she didn't suggest to raise the dose or anything, to stay on it and stop breastfeeding. So the other thing too is, when you go to a psychiatric hospital, they go through all of your stuff, and one of the things that I had packed was my Zoloft. And they took it from me, and they didn't give it back, which the psychiatrist said that I was going to be breastfeeding, and I have it. So
I think your story is also, can I give another reason why your story is so important?
Yes, please.
Because the media has latched onto postpartum psychosis because it's sexy and newsworthy. But it's also incredibly rare. And, of course, it's important for anyone who's had postpartum psychosis to treat that shit as fast as you can, because it can go to, like, the worst-case scenario so quickly. But because it's been so over... I think your story's so important, because it's, like, we just assume, like, it's, like, you're either sad and you're kind of, you know, don't really want to spend time with your baby, or you're having a psychotic break. And it's not. There's just such a huge range of possibilities in between that are so much more likely. And
Right. It's
important to see that, you know, and for other moms out there, who, you know, so that they can understand, like, we have to build a language for ourselves to be able to articulate what the hell is happening to ourselves.
I wish that, you know, when they give those little pamphlets or all those handouts that I remember seeing before I had my baby, or, you know, within the few days that I was first experiencing this and trying to figure out what it was, maybe it was stuff I found online, you know, if they would just kind of say, like, anxiety can include, you know, what if thinking and believing that, you know, I don't know. I don't know what exactly it would be, but something like that. And talking about what intrusive thoughts are, and that would have been very, very helpful, I think. And the term I learned afterwards was normalized. It doesn't, and like you have said in some recent blogs, podcasts, it's not normal, but in that everyone does it, or it happens to everyone, but it can happen, and it's common. And you know, one point someone said that my symptoms were within the normal range of postpartum depression, but I never heard that. That was what was said about me, again, because I read all my medical records afterwards. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about that, but not right now, because I was going to finish up another thought I had, was that this psychiatrist basically was misinformed about medication, but she did say that I should go home. So I went home, And I went home without any medication. And I wasn't really sure about that. And about after being home for about a day and kind of having a little panic attack, I decided that I was going to talk to my husband and I was going to tell him, because he's, even though he had been kind of not the most supportive in the past, he doesn't get crazy about things. You know, if I say this is what I think I need to do, he's just a really good sounding board. You know, he won't, he'll just kind of sound back to me what I said. So I said, you know, I don't know, the doctor, you know, this person thinks I have psychosis, this person thinks I have severe depression, I'm suicidal, the psychiatrist says I just have anxiety, so-and-so says we need to, you know, send everyone home. I was like, but this is what I think. And I think what's most important is if you support me in what I think. And I told him all the stuff I thought I needed. And he was like, yeah, sounds good. That's what you need. So, and one of those things was I wanted to go back on Zoloft. And he was like, okay. And we went, you know, like the next day, we had an appointment in my general practitioner. Well, because at this point, too, I had told my midwife office that I hated them. Maybe I didn't tell them I hated them, but I did express that I was really angry that they had told me to go to the hospital and that the hospital had told me to go to the ER. And, excuse me, the ER had told me to go to the mental hospital. And so I decided I wasn't, you know, I wasn't really sure what was going on, but I just thought I don't really need to go through my midwife. I should just go through my general practitioner. And she prescribed me the Zola. And I pulled out all the stuff I knew about myself and knew about anxiety, and or even it, I didn't even know it was really all anxiety. It was just I knew what I needed to do well. And part of that was getting enough sleep and just the real basic stuff, like sleep, shower so you feel good, rest, eat well. And I found television really triggering. Like, I used to watch, like, Law and Order, and I couldn't, you know, I just wouldn't do any of that. Like, I would, and I spent a lot of time nursing, and my son was a very, very long nurser, and I had yet to figure out how to nurse and hold a book. So there was a lot of me just sitting and nursing him and watching, like, bland television, or my mother-in-law did, in fact, stay, and she was hugely helpful. I will always kind of say, if somebody, I don't think she saved me, but if somebody was very close to really making, you know, a huge impact, she just had the right way. She was like a nurse to me, bringing me my meals. And I think because I've had this relationship with her where I know she loves, she's Italian and she loves to cook and she loves to make things, and I've always kind of, like, appreciated it, but I also kind of, like, I'm an independent woman. Like, I can do stuff myself, but I was just like, I'm going to let her help me. And she really helped me this week. So it was, like, the week I got back from being in Brattleboro, the mental hospital I was in, she stayed with me for another week, and she and her husband, I think, also kind of supported my husband so that he could support me. And I definitely got better. Like, when people talk about, like, when did it get better, I thought that I was not 100% better, but significantly, like, 10 times better by, like, day 15. So my baby was born. I started feeling postpartum depression on day 3. On day 9 of my son's life, like, the shit hit the fan. And then every day after that, it got a little bit better, a little bit better. And then, and I remember these milestones. Like, they were very clear milestones because I was journaling every single day and celebrating every single thing I did that was something to be proud of. And I was still having some I wasn't having sadness. I was still having some anxiety, like some worry about things here and there, but mostly my worrying was about going back to the hospital. I was worried that what if I don't get enough sleep? If I don't get enough sleep, I might have intrusive thoughts. If I tell people I have intrusive thoughts, I might have to go back to the mental hospital. So that was kind of, which is kind of like, it sounds kind of like a PTSD kind of thing from the whole situation. But I continued. My son did take some formula while I was, you know, at the hospital and stuff. But I continued to breastfeed, and I gained a lot more confidence. And, you know, I was supposed to go back to work at about 3 months. And when things were, like, really bad, like, when I just got back from the hospital, my husband had said to me, like, so I guess you're not going to go back to work. And at 3 months, and I was like, oh, I guess we'll worry about that closer to then, but I probably will. And I did, you know, and luckily, because I'm a teacher and the way things fell, like, I went back to work for 3 weeks, and then I had off the summer, and then I went back. And I'm glad I went back those 3 weeks, because it showed me, like, that I could do this, you know? And then I got a big break before I went back again.
You didn't have to spend the whole summer dreading going back.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did kind of go back to work, and I jumped in. I think what was not, I don't know so much if it was postpartum depression, but I talked about it. I wasn't secretive, but I didn't nearly talk about postpartum depression as much as I did later. I feel like that first year I was just trying to, you know, figure out how to be a mom and, you know, deal with the different stages of, like, now the baby's going to sleep. Oh, maybe now the baby's not. Now he's going to tease, you know, he's teething and this and that. So I wasn't, like, really spending a lot of time looking at having had postpartum depression and anxiety and intrusive thoughts, or even what had happened to me. It was kind of like, I knew that I had something like postpartum depression. I knew that I responded to medication, and that whatever happened was really bad, and I never wanted it to happen again. And I wasn't quite sure why that happened, but I knew how to make it not happen, which was all those self-care things I talked about. And that my sanity had kind of been questioned, and that I didn't like that. And I think when I went back to school, I really didn't realize this at the time, but when I had a second baby and I returned to work, and I was like, no, I was like, anything extra that people ask, I was like, nope, can't do it, have a baby, can't do it. But when I went back to work, when my son was like the full time, like really starting back up the next year, so he was like 6 months, I took on like an additional leadership role. I headed every committee. And I don't really think that's like postpartum depression, but I think that was related to my postpartum depression, in that I needed to prove to the world, like, I am not just, I am not crazy. I, in fact, can do a lot, which was fine. I mean, that's fine. I still enjoyed that time. But it just, the next time I had a baby, I was like, are you kidding me? I'm not doing anything. I'm not doing any of that extra stuff. I had a baby. And I have two now, too, which could have been part of it. But when my son was turning close to his first birthday, I started thinking a lot about, you know, oh, it was a year ago today that, you know, was this last appointment. And it really wasn't so much about, you know, and you know, I felt labor cramps and I had a baby. But then it was like, oh, a year ago today was the day we came home from the hospital. And I had that first, you know, scary thought of my son falling off like the table. And oh, this was the day that there was that really big snowstorm and I couldn't get out of the house. I just started writing. And I thought that I was going to write like a really short story. And I thought the short story was going to be about generally how I had done a lot of planning to give birth, because I had like some breathing stuff. I didn't quite do what's called hypnobirthing, but I did my own. I just kind of made up my own thing. And I think the effect was what people have who do take this hypnobirthing class, because I enjoyed labor. Like, I think I'm one of the few people who, and I don't think we'll have any more children, but I don't want a third child, but I wouldn't mind a third pregnancy because I enjoy giving birth, which is really weird. But I did, so I was going to write about how I had prepared for birth, but not for babies or being a parent. Just like you might prepare for a wedding, but not really prepare for the marriage or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then this story just kept going and going. And I realized like I had so much to say. And I started writing it right about my son's first birthday. And then so from the time he was one until the time he was two, I drafted the entire novel or memoir, which ended up being like 300 something pages. I would write, and he was like this amazing one-year-old. Like that was like his glory time, because he would sleep from, and I remember the summer that I was home, again, because I'm a teacher and I do have that time off, he slept every day from 12 to 3, and I would just write. And then he'd go to bed at like 6 or 7, and I'd write again. And my house got really messy that year, and but I started writing, and it wasn't even until the end of my book, because what had happened was as I was writing it, I asked for my medical records, and I started looking at those to help piece anything together that I couldn't remember. But I actually remembered everything really well, and the medical records actually just backed that up. But the medical records, I started to dig for more information, like, so what did I have? And my book was completely done. I was done writing the book when I finally realized what I had. Like, and I wrote my story right through my perspective. So, like, it doesn't say I had postpartum OCD. It's not until afterwards that I realized what this was that I had, that these are called intrusive thoughts, and it was anxiety. And, you know, if you read Dropping the Baby and Other Scary Thoughts by Karen Kleinman, like, everything she recommends for, you know, practitioners to say to, you know, a woman who's experiencing these things is like the exact opposite of what people said to me. So it was like a very validating time to read Karen Clemens' book, because I was like, oh, like everyone did everything wrong, accidentally, but because they just didn't know what I was experiencing. But one of the things that I had alluded to this before, the weird thing about my medical record is that it said that the woman, the crisis counselor that was meeting with me, it said that she had become overwhelmed. I thought this was a weird thing for them to write in medical records. She became overwhelmed with other crises going on in the hospital that night, and stop meeting with me. And I actually looked this woman up, and I found her name on my medical records, and I called her, and I told her, like, look, this had happened. I don't know if you remember me, but, like, what happened? And I told her that I ended up going to a mental hospital. And she said, I never told them to do that. I didn't make that recommendation for you. And so, and she was, like, really shocked about that. And I also said, well, it also says here that you became overwhelmed with other responsibilities. And she's like, that's not true. I thought you were okay, so I stopped meeting with you. And so that was really fishy to me, that just seemed weird. I don't know if she was lying to save face or what. The other weird thing is, and I don't know if you know this, but apparently we can get like a grade on our mental stability. And it's a grade, and I'm joking, it's a scale of 0 to 100. I think it's called like your GIF, your global index functioning or something like that. And I had scored like really low, like a 25 or something. And if you were to look that up in the DSM, like that's like being mute and really, really close to like smearing feces. And I just couldn't believe that somebody had given me that number. Like, I know that's not what I was like that night. I was talking and highly anxious. But so I really feel like some really major messed up thing had happened with, like, my paperwork. The other thing, too, is that I was, they were doing like a suicide risk assessment of me, and it was like an 11-page document. And like the first few pages were filled out, and then the rest were completely blank. And then the very last page, it just like stamped nice and big. It said, you know, emergent risk, you know, send to inpatient immediately. And I just scratched my head at that. Like, it's just, I've written many letters to the hospital that I've never sent. And I've also sent some emails that I have sent and never been returned. And I went to speak to someone in patient liaisons one time, and she basically rolled her eyes at me and just basically told me, well, you know, sorry you feel you didn't need to go to the hospital, but the mental hospital, but, you know, we err on the side of caution, so sorry. And I still, even if it's been 6 years, I still would like to educate the, not just, you know, healthcare professionals, but the healthcare professionals in particular who I dealt with that night at the ER. You know, I just feel like they just were ill-informed in so many ways.
Amen. Yeah, there's plenty of people along my journey I'd like to educate. So, you're planning on, like, re-releasing your book at some point?
Yeah, so I, because I'm a teacher, I don't know, I mean, I guess anyone would say because I'm a lawyer, because I'm a, you know, whatever. There was a time when there was a lot of, I just wasn't sure how it would be perceived by the students I teach and the parents of the students I teach. I always felt very supported by my school district and administration because I've shared with different people my story and stuff, but I just didn't know if I wanted my name attached to the book. But I've since realized, like, they actually don't, they don't think these people care. Like, if people wanted to know that I wrote a book, they could know, because if you were to, like, Google my name, it will eventually take you to Anna Claire Rouds and Dancing on the Edge of Sanity. There's connections through Facebook stuff. And I tell people, too, like, I was very open last year when I led Climb Out of the Darkness, and I put things up about going to different conferences and reading different things. And so I think what I'd like to do is, and if I had the time this summer, is when I'd like to do it. I'd like to write sort of like a second introduction to my book or something, and explain why I did a post, you know, a pen name, and why I'm letting the pen name go, and just kind of call it a second edition. The thing that I realized, and I don't know how you dealt with this, and I'd really be interested in hearing, is it's not just my story, it's also the story, you know, there's very much my husband's story, or they're in the story, my husband, my mother, my in-laws. And one of the things that I liked when I was writing under a pen name, and I pretty much, like, the whole time I was planning on writing under a pen name, I could tell all. It was a story that just told all, and there was no holding back. And now, my reservations about using my name isn't really so much about my story. I mean, there's a little bit about that, because it's one thing to be like, oh, I have anxiety, but it's another thing to really, like, explain it in the depth that I do in my book. But I think I'm okay with that. It's more that, and this, you know, this isn't something that I've come to completely on my own. This is something that other people have actually told me to think about. And I've yet to be one of those people who doesn't worry about other people's opinions. But it's like, you know, people are going to have a certain opinion of your mother or a certain opinion of your husband when they read this. So when you're protected by a pen name, they are too.
Right.
And I think it's particularly my husband, because he really wasn't emotionally supportive of me when I was going through this. And there's a very negative picture of him painted in the book. And that isn't the full picture of my husband. And there's, you know, what's left out is his story. And he's not a writer.
Right.
He doesn't get to tell a story. I've asked him. I was like, do you want to, like, a chapter? Like, I would love for him to write a chapter. I feel like what's missing is that I probably had some rage and definitely some total shortness with him that isn't even fully explained in the book. So when he's, like, not being nice to me in the book, it seems like, what a jerk, you know? It's like, he was struggling too, and I wasn't innocent. And I tried to write a balanced book that didn't make me look like this perfect angel.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I worry about that part of it. But then I feel like maybe I just find a way to explain that in my new opening.
I think,
you know,
yeah.
that he, you know, I don't know how to say it, but basically everything I just said.
Well, and I think that's something that I'm struggling with, because I'm, you know, I've put my name out there and I've told my story already. You know, even if I decide to hold back on the book, it's too late. The internet has all this. And I'm trying to find the balance between showing, like, because I had, like, I hired an editor, and her first, one of her big comments was, you're making this Nathan seem like a bit of a monster. It's like, okay, that's not what I want to do, but I also need to show, like, this is where I was mentally and emotionally, and it's how I was perceiving him. But I also am trying to show, like, okay, this is what he would have done and what he would have said and how an outside observer or non-PPD Courtney would have seen it, but this is how I saw it. Does that make sense? And it's tricky, and you might just, not saying rewrite the book, but I think you concluded a scene at the end about you guys talking about it a bit, and that humanized him a lot. And maybe you want to do even an epilogue with, like, an update of, we had a second baby and this is how it went, and include a scene that shows him being, you know, just shows you guys being good together.
Right.
That'd be another way to do it. But I think just talking about your concerns in the prologue, like, he's, you know, and just coming out and saying, like, he's not an asshole, but he's going to come off that way because this was a terrible experience. And, you know, I mean, Nathan said things during it and acted like I didn't need the help I needed. And he was going through his own entire journey, because you don't sign up. I don't care how much you mean you're till death do us part vows. You don't sign up for mental illness.
I know.
You're not trained for it. And it's so important, this part of your story, for other moms, because I've heard so many stories of, like, either the husband wasn't stepping up, or the husband's stepping up, but it's still, mom's just in such a shit storm. She can't see it, and she's feeling the rage, and, like, this is just part of the story, and it's messy, and it sucks, but it's part of it.
Yeah, I know, and I feel like, and this could have been against the way things were going through my eyes, but I felt too, when I started to read stories, like, whether it was just a blog story, or I think maybe I felt this way about Brooke Shields' book, it was like these amazing heroic husbands who came in and knew just what to say and just what to do, and it made me feel really bad about myself and the relationship that wasn't us, you know? And then I was like, well, that's part of just moving on. And, like, that isn't you. And I will say that, like, when I had a second baby, I fully embraced this. My husband isn't going to know what to say all the time, but he is so good at following directions when I explicitly lay them out for him and he understands how important they are. So when I had another baby, it wasn't just like an accident. It wasn't like a maybe we'll try. It was 100% planned, super duper mapped out situation. And part of it included, like, I was like, okay, so if I have postpartum depression again, this is what I want to happen. This is what, you know, all the different levels too. Like, if it's really severe, this, if it's not so severe, this. And I was like, and most of all, these are the things I need you to say. And it was basically just like, I love you. you can get through this. And like, you know, tell me, please tell me, you know, when you're ready to tell me about your feelings, I'm ready to listen. You know, and I think I even like wrote this stuff down on a paper for him. But I was like, these are the things you're going to need to say to me if I have a hard time. Which again is another idea, like some of that thinking, was from a book I read called, What Am I Thinking? Having Another Baby After Postpartum Depression, which is also by Karen Klein. And so that's another book out there for moms who maybe want to have a second baby. I found that to be invaluable. And I will also say, and you gave me this idea when you said, you know, like an epilogue. I didn't have postpartum depression when I had my daughter, who's now two. And my husband, he was emotionally supportive. Even, you know, I didn't have a second baby, but he was just, I mean, I didn't have a second postpartum depression bout, but he was, in general, he was more relaxed. I was more relaxed. He was really happy. The baby was, like, so easy. Like, she's still, like, we won the lottery with her. And, so he was so helpful and practical. He was so helpful in a practical way. Like, he let me sleep. He took 100% over getting my son to daycare. And so while he didn't, you know, while we had some struggles with that first child, I would say overperformed with the second one. And that's another nice thing of information. I might even, if I, you know, re-release the book, I would include that information about our relationship.
Yeah, and just the fact that you didn't get it again, that would, I think, give so much hope to so many women out there.
Yeah, I definitely think that's, you know, and I totally respect and understand women who just make the decision that after postpartum depression, they're not going to do it again. And I was at a crossroads where I wasn't 100% sure. And again, I think it's like I said before, people were like, I didn't know if I was crazy, and people said, you're crazy, and I fought back. I was like, I don't know if I should have a baby. I don't know if I want it. And somebody said to me, yeah, you know what? You shouldn't have one then. And then my response was, hell yeah, I'm having that baby, you know? And I just needed to give myself a little bit more time and really have a strength in. And I'm glad, you know, for me, and not having a second baby would have been postpartum depression win, and it's been giving to fear. And it was so useful to have a very different experience. And again, like I know many women's stories, they say that they didn't bond with their baby, or they don't remember the first year. I do feel lucky that I got better pretty quickly, and I have many, many happy moments with my son for his first year, but it was still nice to come home from the hospital with a 3-day-old baby and not feel my blood, you know, my blood pressure raising every time she cried. And like, I did all those things that people say you should do, like sleep when the baby sleeps and let other people take care of different things for you. And I really lived it up. So it was great.
And I think your story about your husband's role, it's so honest, and I've got to believe that Brooke Shields maybe gave people a little more polish than they actually had in real life for fear of not wanting to hurt people, but really,
yeah.
You're doing such a service because, you know, let's give a bone to the husbands. They are not trained for this. And they're taught from such an early age that they have to, like, push their emotions down. And they have to, like, have that stony, strong face. And you're just validating for so many women that this is not easy for the husbands either. No one's
right.
Taught them how to deal with this. Usually we're their person. And we're the person coaching them when they don't know how to, like, handle a really emotionally difficult situation. Like, we either coach them or we step in and navigate those waters for them. And then suddenly they're expected to do it all on their own. And the person who helps them figure out their emotions is just not able to do that because they're the ones who's suffering and in distress. So you're just, I think, because, and there are some men who, like, I had this great interview with Tyler, Kalina's husband, and he just got it. But, you know, he was in the military, and he had some serious post-PTSD. I can never get that whole phrase out. And so he had, like, dealt with and processed so many of these emotions that he was prepared. And most of our husbands just can't be Tyler, and they need to hear the Tylers of the world to help them figure out what they should be doing. But most of us just can't expect our husbands to be the hero in that situation, because, you know, Hollywood puts, you know, like my dad, I was writing a section in my memoir about like a little conversation I had with my dad. And the thing is, most of us don't have the Hollywood dad who's able to say that, you know, those like those sentences. It's like, oh gosh, dad. And they hug and it's like so beautiful. Like most of us, our dads are just like doing their best and they don't know the right words in a situation like that. And most of our husbands, they're not Hollywood husbands. And no one wrote a romantic script for them to say, for George Clooney to like rattle off. So like, go you for being so honest with where things went. And
thank you.
And go to your, you know, I don't know how, I forget your husband's name, but, you know, rock on to him for, like, clearly, I'm sure he gave you the green light on releasing the book, and he'll give you the green light if you decide to re-release it with your name attached. And to just allow that vulnerability of, like, yeah, I was not perfect. I was human. And most of you dudes out there, you are not going to be perfect, and that's okay.
Yeah, he definitely was, you know, okay with me writing it. And, you know, I think he too, like, he's provided support for friends, I think, that have maybe, just because I've been so open about it and it's all over my Facebook page. So then, like, one guy kind of, like, reached, one of Jonathan's friends, and my husband's name is Jonathan, reached out to him and said, you know, I know that your wife posts about postpartum depression, and like, I'm not sure about my wife. And, you know, the guy didn't even know me, but he knew Jonathan. So, and I, you know, Jonathan was just there for him, I guess, you know, and then afterwards he connected me through. So there's another level of support out there. Like, the dads need the support from each other.
Oh, tremendously.
So, you know, what to do and what to say. And that's helpful. One of the things that was hard for me, and I don't know what you're doing in terms of comments from your book, but I wanted like Amazon comments or Goodreads comments to help promote it so people would find it. And somebody wrote, you know, and I was ready for, you know, like, you're a bad writer or anything like that. I, you know, I put myself out there. Somebody wrote on one of my, it was probably Goodreads, you know, and they didn't write, like, you know, on a Claire Rouse book. They wrote directly to me in second person, and they wrote, you know, you are, your husband is lucky to have you because he's an asshole. And I think out of all the comments, like, even somebody who told me that my book is, like, boring or whatever, you know, I need the map to follow it. You know, these are some of the unfortunate negative things you get. But that was the most hard to take because it was such a personal attack, I thought. And I was so, like, I don't know. I was upset about that one for a while. And I was, but then I realized, then this person also commented about other stuff too. And I kind of just came to the decision, like, okay, so this is this person's stuff. Like, they're, this person might have their own stuff going on.
Yes.
And they're just projecting on me. And
yes.
So I don't know. So I just wonder, like, are you planning on letting people, are you going to have places where people will be commenting on your book? And how do you think you might deal with that? As I turn the interview to you.
No, it's, I mean, I'm definitely going to try to post the book for sale everywhere and make it available. Good. So I don't think there's a way you can shut down Amazon comments.
No, I guess you can't.
No, and I'm fine with that because I don't do comments on my the podcast's website anymore because most of the comments, like 99%, were like spam coming from Russia. And,
Right.
no offense to my Russian listeners, I love you, but the spam was just like random crap. So it's like, I don't have time to deal with this. But I'm going to just try my best, I think. As you were telling me about that comment that was in the second person, I just finished reading The Four Agreements. I forget the author's name, but he talks about how you can't take anything personally. Nothing is personal. Everything, and it's actually selfish to take things personal because everything is coming from someone else's life and their biography, and you just don't know what's going on in their life. And yeah, that comment she made about your husband's an asshole, that's all on her, and probably her husband's an asshole, and she can't even see it, and it's easier for her to like get angry at your husband. So
Well, obviously, I don't know about that, but I was kind of just like, whoa, and then I step back a bit and
but my strategy was probably going to be to try to not take it personally, and then to talk about it with my therapist, and then to call you and cry about anything crazy that people post.
Well, you've got that.
See, we've got this community, and then
Really?
I know Tabitha too with her book, so I can just tap into the community because
That's good.
we're putting this out there and women really need this. But yeah, we are making ourselves incredibly vulnerable. But I can't wait for the day that I get the comment that Kelly got. Oh my gosh, I'm blanking on Kelly's last name, where he said, like, she was getting comments about you need an exorcism, you need holy water sprinkled on you. I'm like, maybe I'll get that, and that'll be awesome because that'll be like the best possible story to tell at a cocktail party.
I don't know how I would deal with stuff like that. Even I just remember reading reviews of Brooke Shields' book, and somebody was like, "Wow, she's so like melodramatic and self-centered," and it's like, oh, okay, person, like I didn't see that at all, but that perhaps can be part of this illness when you're really in the thick of it. It's not, I wouldn't call it self-centered, but you're really, you're worrying about yourself a lot because there is something to be worrying about. But unfortunately too, even just with her comments, I remember more of the negative feedback about Brooke Shields' book, I think, than the positive. And it's probably just, again, that's my story. That's, I'm a highly critical person, so I that kind of stuff like glues to me. But I do
Which
I
one
do
is
think that was one of the
Repeal's
hard
book?
parts. And so that'll be one of the hard parts about revealing my real name. But I know now that that's going to be hard, so I'm prepared for it.
Which book is Repeal's? I don't think I've read that one.
Oh, Brooke Shields, it's the Down Comes the Rain.
Oh, Brooke Shields. Oh my God, I was like pronouncing, I was in my head collapsing the words together. Hearing like repeal. Okay, yes, of course. Down came the rain. Oh, poor Brooke. Yeah, and there's gonna be, I think maybe with like the bad reviews, it's, and for anyone who out there writes a blog post and leaves it open to comments, or comes on the show and then feels like, well, you're not gonna get comments because I shut those down for you guys. But anyone who makes a Facebook story, you're not necessarily going to get 100% support. And that's unfortunate, but it's why we have to keep hollering and telling our stories and demanding attention.
I think so too. And something that I am also aware of with my own story is that it's pretty, and I would describe it this way, and it's been described this way to me, that it's raw and it's intense and it could be definitely triggering. And for some people, that's a reason why they don't want to read it. And I understand that. And for some people, that might be why they want to read it. But I couldn't tell a different story because this is what it was like for me. Like I wouldn't have sugarcoated my story so that it could get more readers or I could publish it conventionally and get, someone to because I self-published, you know, and I did that because I wanted it out there as quick as possible, and I didn't really know how to go about trying to find somebody else to publish my work, and but
I think indie publishing is such a great way. That's how I'm going to publish, for us to go, mm-hmm. because we retain control. And I've heard horror stories because the publisher can buy your story and then decide to not publish it for whatever reason. And it could be over like some dumb thing, like we're having issues with the illustrator and it's just like, we just need to move on. And then it's like, your story's stuck. You've lost your rights. And I don't want to give up the, like it'd be one thing to lose the rights to like a novel, but like, this is my postpartum story. This is your postpartum story. To give up the rights to someone else, like, oh, ick, I just can't do that.
Yeah, I know. I didn't want it to be influenced by anybody else. Even having people read it. Like, I had a professional editor, and I had, you know, a few friends and family members read it. And I was open to sort of honest, like, there was something at one point in one edition that somebody suggested I take out because it wasn't very true. Well, it was true, but it wasn't going to really help the story come along, and it mm-hmm. could be seen as hurtful. So, you know, I kind of had somebody, a good friend, really kind of pointed that out in a nice way. Like, you might consider moving that part out. But for the most part, I didn't give it to anyone to say, like, chop it up and, you know, spit out a new story. You know, I trusted it with people that understood my mission and my voice and would just make it a cleaner, better version, but not a changed story.
I don't think sugarcoating it would have done anyone a service, because for the people who might be triggered by your story, they're in it, and they could be triggered by just even like a 2-paragraph blog post. And right. if you sugarcoat it, then other moms come along and they read their book and they're like, wow, Sandy had such like a great experience. Like, who am I? Like, am I crazy that I had this intense experience? And by giving all the rawness and intensity of it, you're doing such a service to people.
I did have a friend at one point who was like, after the fact, she was like, so she had a baby, and then she was talking about how she thinks she had postpartum depression, and she was like, I wish I had read your book now, and I said to her, I was like, no, because you didn't read it, now that you're feeling more healthy, you can read it, and I assure you, you will definitely know that I was sicker than you if you read my book. And I mean, that's kind of like, and I don't mean to get into the superlatives of who's sicker, but I don't know, my take on things for her were, she thought she had postpartum depression and she was better now and she hadn't ever had treatment or medication for it. I'm like, there's no way in hell you had something nearly as intense as I did. But she still thought there was like something wrong with her for even having had a hard time. So I was like, yeah, read my book and you'll see how, you know, difficult it can be for some women. But I like to read other people's stories too, because I'm always interested in how different they are. Like, I don't know how people could go on for months. Like, I don't know if it was that mine was like more intense, or I'm just like super, super in touch with my feelings, but I couldn't, this sadness and anxiety, it kind of wasn't an emergency, I guess, in that I knew that it immediately needed like help. Like, I couldn't stand it. So I don't know. Like, you had like quite a while where you, before you went, got help, I think, right?
Yes, and I just let it get worse and worse. And I don't think I'd had your awareness going into it. And mm-hmm. I don't think I had quite, because you had like that day long panic attack. And
yes.
I don't think I had, my anxiety just was sort of like the frog in the kettle, and you keep turning it up a degree and you can eventually okay. boil the frog boil the frog in the water because they just don't notice the temperature going up. That's how it was for me. And it's just, yeah. And it's like, I was reading your book and I was just like, holy shit, I can't even imagine falling apart this quickly. And it, like, that would have been scary to me. Like, if I had gotten that bad that quickly, I don't know what would have happened, because it took me that long to get the courage to ask for help.
Well, and I feel like I think that a lot of women who have experiences like mine do end up in the emergency room because something is wrong that's an emergency. And I was actually just listening like a few weeks ago or whatever. I don't know if it was NPR, but definitely VPR did a week on mental health. And one of their topics was like the crisis of ER crisis centers and how, you know, there's no other place for people to go. Like they're having a mental health crisis, so they go to the ER, but the ER isn't quite equipped. And that's where I feel like we need more education. Like if we'd had more people at the ER that, like a lot of the crisis counselors in my area have a lot of experience with drug and alcohol training. And I think it would have helped if I had spoken to somebody whose expertise was just more in like generalized anxiety and depression and had maybe, you know, reached out to Postpartum Support International or Postpartum Progress was just becoming an organization at the time, like a nonprofit, I think. But even the stuff, I mean, one of the things that I read, like, I don't know, with 2 years after the whole experience, it was so validating for me to read was a blog from Postpartum Progress that basically delineated what, you know, postpartum psychosis and postpartum anxiety. And I'm pretty sure it was kind of like a T-chart or something, and I compared it to stress that really helped me realize, oh, so I didn't have psychosis. Like I've been going around for a year wondering if I had psychosis, and now I'm, you know, pretty sure I have it. Not that you should like diagnose yourself based on stuff you read on the internet, but obviously that stuff was very well written and informed. So I don't know. I don't know if people in the ER could have given me those resources if that would have helped me.
Yeah, a little transparency in the process.
Yeah, that too would have helped.
And I mean, you just deserved to know your diagnosis because you had a second child. And you deserved to be able to prepare, like, are we watching for psychosis? Because in that case, you're watching for very specific things. And, or are we watching for anxiety? And you deserved that knowledge. Okay, well, yeah. I could talk to you and keep you stuck in your, where'd you go? In your car for, you know, for hours. But maybe we should wrap up here.
Definitely.
And I think I am going to do your episode probably in two chunks, like chunk one, your story, and chunk two, all of us talking about writing and all that great advocacy stuff. So, but you'll just say goodbye now once to our listeners. So
okay.
I hope they don't feel like you didn't say goodbye last week because she's here. She's saying goodbye again. She's here.
Yeah. Thank you for the long talk and for doing this podcast. I'm so excited that this podcast is out there, so thank you so much.
And tell everyone, where can they get your book? I know it's on Amazon.
Yeah, so Dancing on the Edge of Sanity, written by Anna Claire Rowd, is available on Amazon, and the publisher that I self-published through is Create Space, so you can get it that way. I think it is just a little bit more money. I get more royalties, but I really don't care. So get it for Amazon if you prefer. And I have a Facebook page, and I also have a blog that's my Dance on the Edge of Sanity, because that had been my original title of my book, and then I changed it to Dancing on the Edge of Sanity. So the WordPress is still my Dance on the Edge of Sanity.com.
Perfect. Well, I loved your book, and I meant to bring it with me and didn't, so that I could have read quotes out loud, but I think we had enough to talk about, didn't we? Oh my gosh, we didn't talk about Zumba. My God, we've been talking for an hour and 47 minutes, and we never used the word Zumba. Oh well, we'll just have to talk again about that. You talk about Zumba in your book, so people can find inspiration there.
Zumba's good.
All right, Sandy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So that's it for this week. Head over to ppdadventures.com for show notes or to sign up for the newsletter. And the show notes will have more information about Sandy's book and where you can buy it. Thank you so much, Sandy, for coming on the show. I loved talking to you, and I know we will see each other in person again someday, and that's just so exciting. And now I'm running out of breath because this weird virus has just left me breathless. Maybe it's just all the coughing, maybe it's just the fact that I'm sick, and I need to take a slow, quiet breath and accept the fact that I'm human. And humans, we get sick, but then we recover, and it's just, we get to experience, you know, what the world experiences every year in seasons. You know, our body has the spring, summer, fall, winter just really fast when we have a cold. And it's just a chance for me to lay fallow for a bit and let my brain and body rest and restore. And that's my message to you guys right now. My take-home message is, it's when you've had a mood disorder, it's really easy to hyperanalyze every illness, every negative feeling. But you know, you don't want to be low. You don't want to be too low for too long. If you're suicidal, that's too low. Ask for help. You need to ask for help now. But if you're low, feeling like kind of like, oh my gosh, I've had a cold for a week and a half and I'm sick of having that cold and I'm exhausted, that's okay. That's allowed to happen. That's life. Please go easy on yourselves. Postpartum depression and all maternal mood disorders can be incredibly lonely and isolating, but you are not alone. You will get through this and you can and will make a full recovery. I love you and have a great week.